For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy chasing the fame, playing the game. It'll be too easy.
Well, hey everybody, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and per usual, I am here with my co-host, Kent Straith. What's up, Kent?
Greetings, Calvin. Greetings from here in day three of the Oprah administration. It's been quite a week.
It's been glorious. I got a car, Saeed got a car, Rozi got a car, Gina got a car, everybody got a car. So what do you think of that? What do you think about the possibility of a Oprah Winfrey administration in 2020?
I think it's tremendously unlikely.
I think it is too.
It's tremendously unlikely. I could only say that it would be better, but
nicer.
But there are about a half a dozen people I would put ahead of her in my preference.
Okay.
You know? But that being said, if she decided to go for it, she would win.
I don't think she
needs that kind of autopsy.
I find it interesting that I just read this today, that in a 1999 interview, Donald Trump was asked, you know, if he were ever to run for president, who he would have as his vice presidential candidate. And he said, Oprah. Oh, she's just fantastic. I love Oprah.
She's great.
Then today he was like, I would beat Oprah in a race. So the tides have turned in his love for Oprah, apparently. But that's neither here nor there. That's obviously a reference to everybody kind of losing their minds over this Golden Globe speech that she gave. But today we are continuing our series called Sacred Space. And this is part two of four. And we last week we had a great panel, which was called What is Christianity? And this week we are continuing that with What is Islam? And we have four great panelists here. I believe three have been on the show previously, and one who is not quite here yet has never been on the show yet, as far as I remember.
Isn't on the show now.
No, she will be on the show in a little bit.
Okay.
But you'll understand why she is running late when I start to read her bio. So we're going to go ahead and read the bios, and then we'll be off to the races with questions. So Miss Noor Ali is a freshman at the University of Michigan, which is why she is running late. Her class got out pretty much right before the show started, so she's on her way here. She is also an intern for the Center for Arab American Studies. As a product of a Sunni-Shia marriage, Noor has been able to see two sides of Islam that most don't. It's made her question and appreciate the religion more as she grew up. To Noor, to be a Muslim is to constantly work at attaining full humility and recognizing that the life of this world is nothing but a disillusionment. So I will welcome Noor when she actually gets here.
I'm going to assume until I'm told otherwise, that a Sunni-Shia marriage is roughly analogous to a Baptist-Catholic marriage. I don't – a Protestant Catholic marriage, yeah, maybe? Okay.
Maybe. I don't know. Okay. We'll find out as we go. next up, we have Mr. Rozi Joffrey back on the show. Rozi Joffrey is a Detroit-based documentary photographer and filmmaker whose work focuses on ethnicity, religion, culture, politics, and the changing urban landscape. Rozi is also an educator with the Henry Ford Learning Institute, teaching design and entrepreneurship to middle and high school students in Detroit. Rozi's other interests span across the spectrum of art, design, social justice, entrepreneurship, and storytelling. Rozi attended the University of Michigan Dearborn and received a bachelor's degree in engineering. He believes to be a faithful Muslim is to pursue a life of compassion, dignity, discipline, and spirituality anchored in a belief in God and guided through the praxis of the Prophet Muhammad. Razi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Next up, no stranger to this show, Mr. Saeed Khan. Saeed Khan is currently in the Department of History.
It's Doctor. Dr. Saeed.
No, he's not Dr. Oh, Saeed Khan.
That's right.
What we always get corrected
mistake
on.
Mistake we made before.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, Mr.
Do I even need to be here while you have this argument?
Mr. Saeed Khan is currently in the Department of History and lecturer in the Department of Near East and Asian Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit, Michigan, where he teaches Islamic and Middle East history, Islamic civilizations, and history of Islamic political thought. Mr. Khan is also a research fellow at Wayne State University's Center for the Study of Citizenship. He is also adjunct professor in Islamic studies at the University of Detroit Mercy and at Rochester College, co-teaching a course on Muslim-Christian diversity. Additionally, Mr. Khan has become a contributor to several media agencies such as C-SPAN, NPR, Voice of America, and the National Press Club, as well as newspaper and other outlets, and is also a consultant on Islamic and Middle East affairs for the BBC and the CBC. Saeed, thanks so much for being back.
Thanks for having me back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Based on that resume, I doubt Saeed will be a guest on Fox News at any point in the near future.
Have you ever been on Fox?
Fox National interviewed me about 11 years ago, and they left every single second on the cutting room floor.
Never again. That guy's too smart. All right. And then last but not least, welcoming back to the show, Miss Gina. I'm going to try this because it looks like it's exactly how it's written.
I sent to you how to say it. Didn't you get my
Ramzanali?
Yes.
See, I mean, it's Ramzanali. Exactly
yeah,
how it's. Okay. Wait, say that again.
Ramzanali.
Ramzanali. Okay. Yeah. All right. Ramzanali. All right. I got it. Well, I only have to say your first name for the rest of the show. So, Gina Ramzanali. She lives in Tanzania, East Africa with her husband and two children. She's been on the show before.
Just my husband.
Oh, just your husband, not your two children.
Yeah,
okay.
No, I don't have two
All right.
Children.
Okay. So you live in Tanzania, East Africa with your husband.
Yes.
But you still have a master's in theological and religious studies from the University of Detroit Mercy, correct?
Yes, they
have not, taken that away.
Right.
For Gina, being Muslim falls in line with what does it mean to be a person of a religious school of thought? How do your actions and thoughts relate to the monotheistic teaching of your belief? Do you practice what the religion preaches or hide behind it like a lot of radical extremist groups? Gina, thank you so much for being back
on
the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go ahead and dive right into questions here. Let's talk briefly about your conversion, if you were not born and raised Muslim, or just your faith journey if you were raised Muslim. And we don't have to go in any particular order here. So say your name and then off to the races.
Okay, well, this is Gina. I am a convert to Shia Islam. I've been a Muslim for about 14 years now.
Okay.
I think what attracted me so much to Islam was that we have a lot of powerful women in our religion that we have as role models. So, and I really dig that, you know, women power. So we have like Sayyida Zainab, we have Fatima Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet, and they're very strong and powerful, and they led their followers to stand against injustice. So I think to me that was really important. So that was very attractive. So having such role models kind of brought me into it. Besides further study on it.
Okay, so what did you convert? Did you convert from just being irreligious? Did you convert from another religion to Islam?
Yeah, I'm Sicilian, so my parents are Catholic. So we are, I converted from Catholicism to Shia Islam.
How did that go over?
It wasn't bad because we have a lot of similar teachings, you know, and my mom was cool with it.
Okay.
You know, the covering and stuff. She kind of told people, you can go be a nun now. You can tell people you're a nun. So she was cool with it. Yeah, they're actually, growing up in Dearborn, they were very open-minded, you know, so with the culture and the religion and stuff. So it worked out pretty well in my favor, where other people I know it wouldn't go over so well.
All right. Very cool.
This is Razi Jaffrey. I was born Muslim to a immigrant family from India. Grew up in Detroit and went to high school in the suburbs. My faith journey is kind of complicated as well in the sense that, you know, I grew up in a house where, you know, religion was just a part of life, you know, and it was just accepted. And I didn't really have a broad understanding of Islam, but I think, you know, my parents had a very powerful connection to the faith. But there wasn't like a lot of choice, you know, and so I think that bore a little bit of distance over time and started getting older and didn't really want to associate with it too much. And then the fateful event of 9/11 occurred, and I was getting questions that I didn't actually have the answers to. And I think for a lot of people in my age group or my generation, it revived a sense of interest in the faith. As an adult, from an independent pursuit. And so I think that at that time when I was in college, it revived an intellectual interest in the history and the tradition. And so that's been kind of evolving ever since then. But I think it kind of became dormant
at some point,
you know, being a teenager and in my early 20s. And then that unfortunately, it took that to, you know, get me more interested in it. And I felt like, as I said, you know, we were getting a lot of questions in our community that I frankly didn't know how to answer. And so I felt like I needed to answer them for myself first and then be able to, you know, respond to them in from an informed position. So.
Okay. Awesome. Saeed?
Okay, this is Saeed. Yeah, I'm a cis Muslim. I was born into Islam.
I think you're using that word wrong. I think you're using it correctly, but that's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, for me, born into a South Asian Muslim family, those two elements of my life were considered to be intertwined. And I think in many ways it shows a lot of the tectonic plates that a lot of Muslims, particularly those who've been reared in the West, have to face. Because for them, Islam is refracted through a lens or through a prism of culture, oftentimes a culture which is not actually that of the United States. And so a lot of the journey or the faith journey then is interspersed with trying to fit in three different buckets. One, of course, is Islam as a religion. One is the culture in which Islam is generally negotiated within the home. And then there's, of course, the culture of America and trying to see in a way that isn't always a rock, scissors, paper way, but something that's a little bit more of an equilibrium is oftentimes the way, as Razi said, the challenge that faces us. And then for me, I spent the first 8 years of my life in Great Britain and then moving to the United States. That in of itself was a culture shock because it's not the same language of English in the
British
UK.
English and American English.
Exactly. And so to go ahead then and deal with that as a challenge and then on top of that trying to fit in yet again, I think a lot of Muslim Americans, and particularly after 9/11, started to feel as the perennial new kid in school, that every day stepping out was another moment of being the new kid who has to face both the hazing, the alienation, and the efforts to try to fit in. Hmm. At the same time, it is a very rich, it's a very vibrant, never dull, never passive exercise to always then have your faith be considered in play and to have a very active engagement with it to see how then it can fit with an ever fluid and an ever changing world.
Okay.
You don't want my faith journey, right?
No, I want to ask the next question.
Oh, you want the next question. All right. I wasn't positive. All right. So beyond...
Yes, Kent, when did you become a Muslim?
Well, I'm not cis. Beyond the Shahada, there is no God but God. Muhammad is the messenger of God. What are some of the central tenets of the Islamic faith? What makes Islam unique in a world where people often claim all religions teach the same thing?
Actually, before you answer, I wanted to kind of point out, I sent these questions out to all of you beforehand, and these are almost identical to the questions that we asked last week of the Christians that were on the panel, and they will be almost identical to the questions that we ask of the Jewish people that are on the panel next week. But it was interesting the answers that they gave, and I wanted to see if there's overlap between the two, and then next week I'll see if there's overlap between the three. But four things that were said about the central tenets of Christianity were, one, it's intentionally diverse. Three, I'll come back to two because two is the biggest one for them. Three, God initiates. Four, you don't change yourself. And two, grace was the biggest thing. There was a big conversation about grace versus works. And so those were four distinctives that were brought up by the people that were on the panel last week. And so when you're answering these questions, yeah, obviously you answer the questions as to what the tenets are, but I'd love to see if there's overlap or if they're completely separate and different.
Okay, well, this is Gina. And so in Islam, we have, to us, it's the prophet Jesus, you know, in Christianity, it's Jesus Christ.
Right.
So Jesus Christ teaches in Islam to live a life of love and kindness. They also teach that in Islam. So it's very a universal message. And Islam teaches us not to ridicule other religions and schools of thought. Imam Ali taught us that a person is either your brother in humanity or he's your brother in faith, meaning that you can't discriminate you know, if you're not of the same religious beliefs, that you have to treat them differently. We have to treat everybody essentially kindly, because that's what our religion does teach, peace. So if you're going to be a peaceful person, you have to, you know, live a life of love and kindness, like Jesus Christ said.
Want to go? Or you want me to go? This is Saeed. So I think that when it comes to Islam, I mean, beyond the rituals and beyond what are seen as the major acts of worship, of prayer and fasting and tithing and pilgrimage, I think that what we have is an emphasis of two main qualities. One is justice, and the other is mercy. And both of these are predicated, obviously, with the belief in God, but also the accountability to that God. And the responsibilities are not just to God, but to a community. And that community is not just defined as a community of believers, but really all of humanity. Mm-hmm. This is why the Holy Scripture in Islam, the Quran, speaks to two different audiences. There are places where it says, or it speaks in the language of, "O you who believe." And then it also speaks, "O you humanity," in a broader abstraction.
Okay. And that's what Gina was saying a moment ago. Okay. Either your brother in the world or brother in faith.
That's right. Okay. And then there's also this idea of the importance of mercy, because after all, if there is the submission to God and to a divine plan and to enter into a divine contract, along with that is the absolute faith that you are going to be arbitrated ultimately by a deity that, as Einstein would say, doesn't play dice, one who will go ahead and treat with absolute fairness, as well as the beneficence and the mercy. And these two qualities then are also supposed to be applied by human beings and by believers to their community. So not only is it a contract with God, not only is it a responsibility to community, but in many ways, Islam also prioritizes your responsibility to yourself. The idea, not in a selfish way, but that even your own body has a right over you. The idea that you should treat it well, that you should not abuse it, you should not defile it. All of these things then create a very important balance and an equilibrium in then living a life that is fulfilling, as well as one that is just and that is upright.
Okay.
Just a couple things that I'll add. I think, you know, well, first, it's there's this idea that I think is well-meaning, that is pursued, it's spread about this idea that all religions are essentially the same. And I think I understand the hope and the aim behind this sentiment, but it leaves for like a very bland society, I think.
And it's not true.
And it's frankly not true.
Right.
You know, I mean, on a very simple level, if one were to accept the beliefs of another religion, it would take one out of the folds or the parameters of Islam. You know, if, for instance, if one were to accept the Trinitarian theology, it would effectively remove somebody
right.
from the Islamic faith. And so I think it's important to recognize differences, and it makes for a more interesting society, and that's what makes for a pluralistic society, that a society that can tolerate and accept people of various beliefs. I think another interesting thing for me about Islam that perhaps might be unique is that it has a rich spiritual and mystical tradition, but it's also deeply embedded in the life of its followers and life of human beings in society in general. And so what I mean is that I think that human beings are primarily concerned with themselves, with their well-being, with their health, with their finances, with their families. And I think that Islam, through its law and its practice, recognizes and supports that. Through the preservation of life as a priority within Islamic law, through the preservation of wealth as among the priorities or among the objectives of Islamic law, it recognizes that there is a deep value in preserving life and also protecting those earthly needs.
Okay. So, I mean, you brought something up that kind of dovetails into the next question. So Islam is a fairly exclusive religion. Christianity is an exclusive religion, right? According to most people who claim to be Islamic, the Shahada declares there. Well, I guess all people who claim to be Islamic, the Shahada declares there is no God but God. Muhammad is the messenger of God. How do you square this message with a pluralistic world, especially with so many other world religions to contend with? So this is like the other side of that coin. Some people say all religions teach the same thing, and then other people are like, whoa, that's kind of an exclusive message, and I have a friend over here who's Christian, and I have a friend over here who's Jewish, and I have a friend over here who's Muslim. How can you guys say, or Buddhist or whatever, how can you guys say that your way is the right way? Are you saying I'm wrong? That's kind of what kind of comes out when people bump up against exclusive religions or religions that have exclusive claims. So how do you square there is no God but God, Muhammad is the messenger of God, against this pluralistic world of many different religions or no religion at all?
You know, I think that in Islam, we consider ourselves the final message, the final book. So we do piggyback off a lot of Christianity and Judaism. The Prophet Muhammad said that if you take your two fingers and you put them together, that's how close Christians and Muslims are. Meaning that they are so similar in teaching that you can go to your Christian brother, you can eat at his house, you can share lives together. It's not that different, because essentially the message of religion is love, you know, and kindness. And if you have love and kindness in your life, then you are a religious person. And if you're a good person, you are, you know, religious. So it kind of goes hand in hand with being kind and being religious. Following God's teachings and being religious, to me, would mean that you live a life of being kind and nice. You know, being a decent person is what it's all about.
Okay. Thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think that Islam is nearly as exclusivistic as the question prompts it to be.
Okay. All right.
There's really two dimensions.
Feel free to correct the question. So I might be asking them wrong. So
No. In the sense, I get the point that you're making or trying to make to be, I think, rightly provocative. But if you think about it, there's really two spaces in which religion operates. One is within the sociological, and the other is in the eschatological. So you're looking at what is it like for life on earth, and how do we concern ourselves there? Mm-hmm. And then the other one is how do we concern ourselves in what comes next? And in both cases, Islam is much, much more inclusivistic. Mm-hmm. There is clearly a space of pluralism, not just of tolerance, but mutual respect and cooperation and coexistence within the terrestrial.
I guess then, and I do want you to get the full answer out, but I do, I guess, want to clarify, I guess, what the crux of the question then is for me. And this is some of the stuff that we went over in the class in yeah. Rochester College years ago. But something Razi said was, hey, you know, if you believe in Trinitarian theology, that kind of takes you out of, you know, being faithful Muslim. I mean, it disqualifies you. I was talking to a guy yesterday and I said, if you don't believe in the Trinity, you're not a Christian. That's like the one thing that all churches agree on is that. And so, and next week we'll get into what, you know, Jewish people believe. But I guess what's at the crux of the question is both these religions, all three of these religions and other religions, of course, make mutually exclusive truth claims, which then necessitates who's in, who's out. Now, you might be more inclusive than, say, Christianity, but there are still some mutually exclusive truth claims. So if you say something like, you know, there is only one God and Muhammad is his messenger, well, that's going to fly directly in the face of Hinduism, right? Yeah, with their thousands of gods.
But that's like this. It's like saying – it's like making certain truth claims about I don't know, pick the sport. Bobsled racing, mm-hmm. Okay? You cannot.
Is it a Jamaican bobsled team?
I was going to go with basketball because I understand
very random.
If you want to be a bobsledder, there are certain things that you have to do. There's certain equipment that you have to use, and there's certain rules and regulations that are in place.
Right.
If you happen to be an Olympic figure skater or a biathlete, there are certain rules and regulations there. That doesn't mean that you all can't come to the same Olympic Games.
Right.
And I think that that's what we have to take a look at.
But one's a figure skater and one's a bobsledder. I would know the difference between the two.
Well, that's the thing, though, that a bobsledder should not confuse him or herself with a figure skater or vice right. versa. Otherwise, things look pretty lousy.
Right.
And, you know, Jeff Gallooly goes after the wrong person with a lead pipe. But
saw that movie last night, by the way.
Did you?
Was it good?
Great.
Okay. All right.
Can't moving on, though. Right. We'll talk okay. about it after.
I saw Shape of Water today. So, anyway.
So the question then comes down to not inclusivity within a religion. Okay. It's inclusivity within a public space. And does Islam therefore create an exclusivity that neither others can interact and engage with Muslims, or are Muslims impeded by their religious tenets from interacting with other people? And that doesn't exist. On to the second point, when it comes to the afterlife, Islam is actually much more inclusivistic when it comes to who gets into heaven. The Quran, again, speaks about those who are Jews, those who are Christians, those who are Sabians, which is a group of people from Yemen, as well as those who do good deeds. Mm-hmm. They have nothing to fear. So this demonstrates that eschatologically or in the afterlife, it's not just going to be an all-Muslim heaven.
Right.
So I think that these are the two things that, of course, concern people the most, what's going to happen here on earth and what's going to happen in the place and in the time to come.
And if I'm not mistaken, and this is just from very brief reading and not having studied Islam as much as anybody here on this panel has, but as far as something I came across, the Prophet Muhammad had said something along the lines of essentially, I'm not saying this completely correct, but the idea that eventually whatever the Muslim concept of hell is, it will eventually be entirely empty. Like, it's not an eternal state of being, that everyone will eventually make it into the Muslim version of heaven. Am I misunderstanding?
Well, no. I mean, if God is infinitely merciful, mm-hmm. then there is the conceit that he will forgive everyone, including Satan. So from that standpoint, and again, it's I suppose a matter of how long is too soon and how long is enough. I mean, when you're getting into infinity, you're talking
right.
about some pretty big numbers.
Right.
But ultimately, yes, there is this idea then that hell will be empty because hell will be irrelevant.
Okay.
Just a couple of quick points. Mm-hmm. So what you were talking about, I was actually sort of extracting three different questions
okay.
from that. You know, one is how tolerant is Islam? Is Islam right, or is Islam more right than other religions? And then the third question is, what I'm understanding is that, you know, Islam is only for Muslims. Like, what aspects of Islam are off limits to people who are not Muslim? You know, and I think that the questioner would have to define, like, you know, what is it that you are unable to experience mm-hmm. In a Muslim community that you would like to, that you feel is off limits to you? I think the first two questions we kind of talked about, but I think that, Muslim culture exists in lots of different societies mm-hmm. outside of the Muslim world, including in the United States. And those are things that are experienced by people on a daily basis, you know, and so, mosques are not off limits. Halal food is available for you to enjoy, mm-hmm. you know, if you like. So I just wanted to, you know, make that point and kind of, I felt like there were actually two or three different questions.
Yeah,
but if I may,
I mean, I think, Rosie, what's so important about that observation is looking at Islam beyond just the theology, and there's an entire culture of Islam. And I think in this day and age when religion and religions are being commodified so frequently and so pervasively, there is this anxiety, and what then creates a false exclusivity among mm-hmm. believers is to say, well, you know, you can't go ahead and tell me about what Islam is because you're not on the team.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So again, figure skaters shouldn't tell bobsledders how to bobsled. And so I think that this is what's driving a lot of the conflicts and I think creating unnecessary barriers that are there. Because somebody, for example, if they wanted to fast, I mean, by all means, no one's going to go ahead and put a gun to your head and say you shouldn't fast. If you want to do it out of a sense of empathy, if you want to do it out of a sense of solidarity, you want to do it for losing weight, I mean, you know, and God knows best. But there's also a danger that something that is taken from another religion and is being appropriated may be done so without understanding all of the context. Mm-hmm. And you see this happening outside of Islam, outside mm-hmm. of Christianity, outside of Judaism. You see this happening with Hinduism and yoga, for example.
Yoga, for sure, yes, absolutely.
So I think it's important then to see why mm-hmm. then there are now these firewalls which are exclusivism that are starting to creep into religions, which I think historically they probably weren't there.
Hmm.
Actually, I wanted to kind of piggyback off of what he said. A lot of people confuse culture with religion. They so if you're an outsider and you're looking at somebody from a certain country and you say, oh, all these Muslims are like this, it's because they tend to bring in their cultural values and to tie it in with religion and just kind of stir the pot and just that's how they do their, you know, when it might not necessarily be the proper way to follow the religion. It's just kind of what they brought up with, what they were brought up with. Mm-hmm. So we have to kind of identify that you can't mix culture with religion, ideally, but in practice it's done a lot.
Right. I mean, religions take place within the container of culture. I mean, right. There's no escaping it. Where the question comes from, and Razi, I like the fact that you extrapolated three questions out of there, primarily because they might psychologically in the very back of my mind be there, but I'll admit, you know, I come from a very modern Christian background. And so grew up with the whole, you know, you got to defend what you believe. And so for me, I've never thought, oh, I'm not welcome in a mosque. I've never once thought that I have no access to the Islamic faith. I know I could walk into a mosque any day that you guys are open and worshiping. I probably wouldn't unless invited, and I probably would view it the same way that – or the reason I don't go to a mosque is probably the same reason I don't go to a Catholic church. I'm Protestant Christian, so if I go into a Catholic church, I feel uncomfortable because I don't know – when do I stand?
You
when
don't
do
know
I
what's
sit?
Going on.
What is going on? Okay, everything's moving towards this big table at the front. I don't know what to do. And so if it came to a mosque, I'm sure if I went several weeks in a row, I would get it pretty quickly. Same thing with the Catholic church. I think I would get it pretty quickly. But I think by and large, I've never felt unwelcome. It's just a matter of, I think I was raised in such a way of asking the question, is this true? And Saeed, you and I have had conversations where I've asked, you know, how come I don't see a lot of Muslim atheist debates? And I mean, we're not going to go into all that, but it's a very different emphasis on things where I've been to a million Christian versus atheist debates because we have to defend. We have to defend. We have to know who's in, who's out, who's right, who's wrong. And it seems in the answers that I'm getting here that that doesn't seem to be as big of a concern. Not that we shouldn't get the right things right within Islam, but there are a whole other host of ideas outside of Islam about welcoming the stranger that I don't think that Christians, in terms of thinking, is this right, is this wrong, is this true, is it not, are really concerned about.
So part of it, I think, Calvin, is displacement. From what I see in looking at Christianity in America, Christians in America probably have more, and this is going to seem like heresy to some, have more in common with their Muslim neighbors than they do with Christians overseas. I would say, I mean, and certainly in our interaction, I think we probably have more in common with one another than you would have in common with a Coptic Egyptian sitting in Cairo or mm-hmm. Alexandria. For Muslims, I think right now that is still a much more fluid situation. They certainly have a lot in common with their non-Muslim brethren in America. But the connectivity of being part of an ummah, this sort of global Muslim phenomenon, mm-hmm. then is something that creates sometimes confusion, sometimes conflict, sometimes wondering, well, to which do I have at any given moment a slightly higher, not allegiance, but prioritization of need. And so these are then the little cracks or the microaggressions which then can militate against both non-Muslims in America seeing their Muslim neighbors as being quote-unquote loyal and also be a matter of confusion for Muslims to say, well, we've got it relatively okay here. Should I have more empathy for people overseas? So these are the issues that go beyond just simple categories of theology and okay. ideology.
But I think you could say that because if you think about it, a lot of Americans don't travel overseas to meet other – like Christians from America don't travel overseas and meet other Christians where they could have that connection. You know, so
if
I
they
think,
do, all they're going to tell them is how they're worshiping wrong because it's not the American way of
worshiping. Yeah, or just trying to go there to save them. You know, they want to be the savior. So I think that if they actually did go overseas and traveled more, a lot of Americans, we stay in-house because everything is here. We have every convenience is here. So why would you go outside and see what else is going on in the world, you know?
Right.
So that's why they probably don't have that Sith connection.
But let's say even Americans who travel to, say, Europe more than from to, say, South America, Africa, or Asia, they're going to encounter a post-Christianity. And
right.
So you find that a lot of Americans, when they go to Europe and they're told, we don't do God here, they are mortified by it. And conversely, a lot of Europeans come here and are mortified that that Christian Americans are so Christian. The fact that I've had so many Europeans, especially journalists, come to the Metro Detroit area and say that they were totally offended in Dearborn. I'm like, what offended you? They said, oh, other Christians are asked, how often do you go to church? And they said, we would never ever ask a question like that. That's like asking somebody's age or weight or sexual preferences, is what they said.
But then if you go overseas,
I'm not sure
you can...
I would ask that question either of anybody.
Yeah, that's weird. But then if you go overseas, you could find more devout, you know, Christians per se. And then Christians here would say, well, we follow the New Testament. We don't follow the Old Testament, as opposed to they follow the whole book. You know, so they wouldn't have that connection as well.
Now I will say this is in I'm seeing this kind of come out as well. And again, Saeed, you and I have kind of had this conversation offline. But one of the big concerns within Christianity is to evangelize, right? You go out and you share everything. And during, you know, after the election of Donald Trump, I was really just flirting with the idea of just abandoning Christianity wholesale, since it seemed like every other Christian had abandoned Christianity wholesale in a pursuit for power. And that was when we started this show, and we started having episodes about Islam, and I was like, that's kind of, you know, fascinating. It's close enough. And I thought about it. I honestly thought about it, started reading a little bit. But then something that bothered me was that there's no impetus to proselytize in Islam.
Not true at all.
Well, we don't go door to door and knock and say, you know, well, yeah, I mean, have you read your Quran?
I'm not doing that either. But I guess the focus is different. The foci is different in terms of evangelization within Christianity, which is what I guess I was used to, in Islam. Like, I never felt there was a, so you're going to make a decision about this or not. Like, there was never that moment from anybody. And I was like, okay.
It's not really a commercialized religion where we would tell people, you know, this is what it's all about. Do you want to come join us? It's kind of something that we feel that you have to study and learn on your own, because that's how you would gain the relationship with God.
I would actually respectfully disagree. I think that there's enough, for lack of better words, televangelists now in Islam. There's enough social media presence among some individuals. Some have gotten themselves into trouble with sexual harassment and sexual assault, but that's a different
not naming any names.
No, we'll stay away from that knock list. But anyways, what we have to recognize, though, is something that is happening across the board to religion and religions, and that is the manner in which religion is being communicated, not only to those who are already practitioners within that community, but moving beyond it to others, both to save and to preserve space within the public discourse, but also to try to reel people in. I mean, there's something profitable today about religion. There's something about market share about religion. And I don't know if any religion is particularly immune to this. Some are better equipped at handling it. It's just like how some people are more tech savvy. Some people are more savvy with how to go ahead and create the narrative of promotion. But that means it's also a zero-sum gain. If you are promoting your religion and bringing somebody over, that means that they're leaving something. So even religions that are not proselytizing religions are going to be affected by those that do so in earnest.
That is true, though, I would have to say, because if you go around the Metro Detroit area, you will see billboards that say, like, 1-800-JOIN-ISLAM, you know, and then they have, like, do you have a gin problem? You know, so you could actually call and talk to somebody, and then I think essentially they kind of try to talk you into it. But
well, that would mean it would be a 900 number then.
And you have to pay for it, yeah.
So, okay, so yeah, let's continue talking about that for just a second, though, because you go to, let's say you go to Royal Oak, Michigan on a Friday night. There's going to be somebody standing on the corner on a soapbox preaching something. It's generally going to be Christianity. I can't say, even if when I've been to Dearborn, I haven't seen that from Muslims or from Jews. I see it, that there's this impetus within Christianity to do that kind of thing. You'll see videos of like this guy Ray Comfort going out there and like, hey, have you ever lied? Have you ever stolen? Then by your own admission, you're a liar and a thief, you know? Nice. And that's why you need Jesus. Like, I don't see Muslims doing that, right?
Well, Muslims may not do that in the same mode, but they do it. At the same time.
In what ways? I mean, just help me. I mean, I've never seen it. So in what ways do Muslims do that?
So two things. One, first of all, I've seen Muslims emulate the way that Christianity is proselytized.
Okay.
Maybe not so much in the Metro Detroit area, but certainly in the street corners of Manhattan, Philadelphia, Toronto, and most recently London.
Yeah, Windsor.
So just not a thing here. Okay. Yeah.
So that is, again, emulation because they figure that this works. At the same time, when it comes to those Muslims who live in the West – who then employ certain proselytizing ways, it'll probably be a little bit more subtle. It may be a bumper sticker. It may be, for example, having the proverbial water cooler conversation. But it is done so in a much more nuanced way than perhaps what we do. And that might actually be a cultural thing.
I don't think – it's not very direct. Like somebody won't walk up to you and be like, do you know God? Yeah, it's usually not done like that.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Kent, next question.
There have been various views about religious influence on government down through the years here in America. What do you believe the role of Islam should be in shaping public policy? Should Muslims be involved in politics?
I want to say that growing up in Dearborn, there's always been the stigma that I've heard from outside, you know, people that don't live in the Metro Detroit area, that Dearborn is run by Sharia law, which I always thought was really comical because then if they actually came to visit, they would see we have, you know, many different places you could go to that would be the opposite of Sharia law. You know, like there's like a ham place and strip clubs and stuff. So I think that...
There's a ham place?
Yeah, there's a ham place. I mean, it's on Michigan Avenue. It's called the ham place. Oh, yeah, nice. They have ham sandwiches, I guess. So,
it would be weird if they didn't.
Right.
We don't sell that here.
They're very direct with what they have, yeah. Right. So, I think that it's kind of funny to me because Sharia law is something that we can't follow in the U.S. because we have to go by the law of the land, right? So, living with the law of the land, Sharia wouldn't apply to America or Americans.
But I think at the same time we have to recognize, and this is a really dirty little secret, that America is in many ways perhaps one of the most Sharia-compliant countries. There is, if you take a look at the principles that are espoused within Islamic law, you'll find that that is very much in concert with how the American legal system is structured. At the same time, I think that to get back to the initial question about what role does Islam play in public policy, I think the paramount role is to preserve the structure and the architecture of the American legal judicial system. I think particularly given the fact that it is the system itself is under attack, whether it is the libel laws, whether it is the judiciary as an institution, whether it is certain things that certain members of the executive branch find to be nefarious. I think that there is a big role that Islam plays in maintaining the status quo of the structure and working from within that structure. Now, as far as whether Muslims want to have something badged or labeled in Arabic or something else, again, that's just posturing and that's just culture. But I think that if we take a look throughout Islamic history, and particularly in those situations where Muslims have lived as minority communities, it has always been to, first of all, uphold the principles that the divine contract demands, one of them being, of course, justice, but also within that to see how the legal system works. Because the one thing that Islam detests is dysfunctionality of a society. And so if society starts to erode for whatever reason, that is unhelpful to anyone, Muslims or non-Muslims alike.
Yeah, but do you think that Muslims should play a role in politics?
Yeah, of course. Why? Because then the converse would be that why should they then artificially exempt themselves from the process?
Right, and take a step back and just do nothing.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Passivity has never been an option.
Are there any sects within Islam that would say that Muslims should not be involved? Because I can point to several Christian denominations that are like, you need to abstain completely from any type of governmental action or participation. So are there any groups within Islam that would say, do not...
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah, there are. Okay. There are groups that are ironically political groups that don't believe
we shouldn't be doing this.
Well, you know, their argument
everything is wrong.
Everything is wrong, and
it's
their,
like the
their
ham
argument,
place doesn't sell ham.
Their argument would be that it's an un-Islamic for you know whatever that means. It's an un-Islamic system, so therefore participating in the system, you know, it would be. Would be a sin, you know.
But somehow or the other, their presence in that system is not considered sinful.
It's totally
exactly.
legitimate.
Yeah. That's what I always thought was very funny is, oh, you should do everything anti-US, anti-American, but then they live here very happily.
And benefit
yeah.
from
oh,
the,
yeah.
you know,
I would wonder, system. I guess I would wonder any group, whether you're religious or non-religious, you're like, yeah, you shouldn't be involved in any type of government. I mean, as far as I understand, as far as I've always looked at religion and government, religion determines your... you know, for lack of a better word, eternal destination. And so it determines your eternal life, and government determines your corporeal life. It orders your world. You know, there's a reason why you have speed limits. There's a reason why you have police and fire and, you know, and garbage pickup and all the, I mean, like if my garbage people in Roseville, if anything falls out of the trash can, they will take the trash and leave whatever trash is on the ground. They won't pick it up. And I have to call my city government and say, hey, can we hire a different trash company? But I do always wonder about groups that are very anti-government or do not believe that people should be involved in government, whether it be for secular reasons or for religious reasons. Generally, it's religious. How our world would be ordered otherwise, especially like if an Islamic group thought that. How would their lives then be ordered by Islamic law? Because then you have other religions that would be competing that would then, if they felt the same way, would be running by, you know, Hindu law or you know, Christian law or Jewish law, and they would all be at odds with each other in some way, shape, or form.
And those people who demand that or who advocate for that clearly are lazy. They just simply don't want to be involved in doing any of the heavy lifting. And
but would you call them unfaithful? I mean, they're coming from a religious point of view.
Yes, actually, well, they come from a religious a particular religious narrative that they've constructed. But I would go ahead and contend that it is really the antithesis of really what Islam or any religion says. I mean, this idea of being living in a gilded cage. I mean, what was it that Pink Floyd said? You know, would you rather be a walk-on part in the war, or would you rather have a lead role in a cage? I don't think that the latter is anything that Islam ever said. Wish you were here.
And Islam has had a lot of leadership throughout history. So, at working in politics, if you're you know fit for the job, you should do it. There's nothing wrong with working, you know, in American politics at all.
Okay.
And on both issues, on the issue of Sharia. You know, sometimes
which I also avoided bringing that up because it seems like almost
but
a tired.
Well,
I'm sure you're tired. I didn't say the word, but you know, whatever.
I mean, I'll just make a quick point. You know, whether people want it or not, whether people understand it or not, whether Muslims want it or not, or whether Muslims understand it or not, it exists in American society. It exists on a very personal level for individuals who are practicing the faith. It exists on an economic level. You can now get a Sharia-compliant mortgage. In financial investments, you can get investment products that are both compliant by the SEC and then also Sharia compliant as well. And so anyone that says, you know, as a Muslim or as a non-Muslim that we don't want Sharia law here, well, I frankly think they don't understand Sharia law and they don't understand the reality of our society and the fact that it's already here.
Okay.
And then there's the vast amount of things in the United States that are Sharia compliant. So many aspects of our society, so many aspects of our government, which are completely consistent with a Muslim understanding of law. On the second issue of should Muslims be involved in politics, whether they should or they shouldn't, Muslims are involved in politics. And in fact, I think, you know, we've had Muslims involved in politics for decades now, but we've seen an immense increase in the involvement of Muslims in politics, you know, both on a national level, on a federal level, on a state level, on a county level, on a district level. And I mean, going all the way from Keith Ellison, U.S. Congressman, Firuz Saad, who's running for U.S. Congress in Michigan, Abdul El-Sayed running for governor, the city of Hamtramck as a Muslim majority city council. And so Muslims are involved in politics. And so inherently within that, there is a tacit approval that Muslims should, in fact, be involved in politics.
Okay.
So,
Noor, what about yourself?
Interpretive Muslim politics.
Yes. Do we have her mic on? She's on two.
Is it working?
Yes, it's working now. Yes. All right. There we go.
So I totally believe that Muslims should be involved in politics. I actually work for Firuz Saad.
Oh, great.
and I think working with Firuz has really brought to light the fact that our voices are not heard or represented at all. You know, we've been attending a lot of Dems meetings in the 11th Congressional District. And for the most part, she's the first Muslim that people have met, which to me is ridiculous because I was born and raised in Dearborn. You know, everybody there is Nahdab or a Muslim. And it's just a wake-up call to meet folks who only live 20 minutes away who don't know that people like us exist.
Yep.
And that we have, you know, liberal, progressive views, because Firuz is running on a progressive platform. So
so you might have more in common than people might think.
Yeah, than people might think, you know. And they're taken aback by the fact that she doesn't wear a hijab and her assistant, me, does. and people like Abdullah Hamoud, they're really changing the game. Abdullah Hamoud has taken a really huge percentage of the people in the reps, as he is, to Dearborn to make them visit the mosque and take them out to eat some Arabic food,
mm-hmm.
because they don't see these people, a lot of them that live in the UP and even just outside of Wayne County. They don't interact with us. So I think it is necessary because we do bring a lot to the table, and it's time that people know that we exist.
Okay. Now, I guess a question that would come up, I guess, is in terms of strides for public recognition, public understanding, visibility. I remember the first I had my first job ever. I was working at a movie theater, and I was in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. We were the second African American family ever to move into Grosse Pointe in 1994.
Wow. Right?
But I remember I was 16 in 96, and this little kid came up to me, and he was precocious as ever, and I think he was like 6 or 7, and he goes, "Excuse me, sir. Why is your skin all dark like that?" And his parents, of course, came up behind him like, "Oh my god, I am so sorry."
He's from Grosse Pointe. I'm like, he's seven.
He should have. Yeah. But people live in these insular communities, and so even though you do have people, you know, of a Muslim background who are running, Abdul El Sayed, you know, for instance, I got to interview him a few months ago with Saba Maruf on her podcast because I help her co-host that, and. Brilliant gentleman, fantastic, brings a lot of visibility to the Muslim culture. What happens if you bring visibility and then you lose? What strides have been made? Do you need to win to make the strides, or is losing still fine because you were visible for a moment? I don't know.
I personally think that losing is still fine, mostly because you just open the door for somebody.
And that's not me saying I think they're going to lose. I'm just saying what happens.
I just think you open the door for so many people working under Firuz and seeing people like Abdullah Sayed at these events that we go to. It's been eye-opening for me because I grew up, you know, wanting to be active in politics and government. I got made fun of for all throughout middle and high school. And then finally seeing it in action, you just have hope that one day you can be in their shoes and make the difference. You know, if Abdullah Sayed isn't going to be the first Muslim governor, you know, like one of my classmates right now at U of M might be. So, and it's because of Abdullah Sayed that they have that kind of courage to take that step.
Well, I think it also it shouldn't be a fool's paradise courage. I think that let's take the analogous situation of Hillary Clinton. I mean, the first major party presidential mm-hmm. candidate. The fact that she lost, I don't think, is going to deter women from running for president. I mean, you don't sort of cash it all in. At the same time. Hillary's ability to run for president was predicated on the idea of the strides of so many women being involved at every level of public service. I mean, from drain commissioner all the way to state representatives and senators, at the national level, Congress people, as well as senators. So I think one of the questions that has to be asked of somebody like an Abdullah El Sayed is that, what about paying dues? is it enough that that there have been enough Muslim Americans who have paid their dues in a system like others, whether mm-hmm. it is based on gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, race, and religion, to then go for these things? Is it premature? Is the question that's going to be asked. And so if and when he loses, the issue is not going to be maybe necessarily because he was a Muslim. And I would certainly hope that people don't necessarily say, oh, this is indicative of some kind of malaise or racism in the United States.
Right. And
it has to do with process, and it has to do with ripeness.
And I wonder about – I mean, first – I guess there's this kind of this idea within the black community, don't be the first person to do anything. Just don't. When Obama won in 2008, when he won, that was, I think, for the first – and my father is a – I mean, my father, black man, but conservative. You know, Obama was the first Democrat that he voted for. I didn't know that, but it was.
You didn't know Obama was a Democrat?
No, I didn't know that it was the first time my father was voting Democrat, right? And so, I mean, he did because, I mean, that was historic. It was a big deal. And forever – it will be etched that we can do this. We can achieve the highest office in the land. It might be a while before the next – we've seen the referendum on that with the election of Donald Trump. But
– well, the worst that's going to happen is the next time it's going to then be a 500 record.
Cause right.
Because right now Obama's batting 1,000.
But let's –
or who knows? Maybe our next president could be a black woman.
It could be. But
are we going back to Oprah now?
Yeah.
But when you've got –
I was thinking Kamala Harris. So, yeah,
well, she could be vice president. I love me some Oprah. But when Hillary Clinton lost, there was an overwhelming feeling on the part of many, many women that see – there were some who said we're never going to get there again. There were, of course, hey, we got to just get back to the grindstone. We are going to get there. But there was a reason why Hillary Clinton was so dejected and didn't even show up at, you know, at her party at the end, because normally the losing candidate still shows up at their party and says, hey, it was a hard night.
The losing candidate doesn't get a lot more votes.
Right. No. I wonder if the predicament that a lot of Muslim Americans who are running for public office for the first time, some higher offices than others, should they lose, will that come with a, see, the world still sees us a certain way, they're never going to vote for us?
I don't think
well,
so.
It shouldn't.
Yeah.
It shouldn't. Yeah, it shouldn't, but I'm cynical enough to go, this state went red. Mm. If we're just considering Michigan right now, this state went red. It overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump. And so
it was like 50.2%.
Yeah, was it 50%? Okay, I'm sorry.
It was overwhelming.
Yeah, look, it was 11,000 votes.
It was enough to go red.
It was 11,000 votes, and 23% of the Muslim Americans in Michigan voted for Trump. So, you know, I mean, if you take a look at that,
yeah. In a related
study,
23% of Muslims don't watch the news at all.
No, but I think the point that you're making is so important because the optics and the construction of the narrative drive so much of this. If for the sake of argument, no Muslim ever got elected to anything in the state, then we could go ahead and say that there's some kind of a pathological hatred about Muslims or a sort of Islamophobia.
Yeah.
But at this point, if somebody goes ahead and loses a particular race, I don't think that that's a presumption that at all should be made. It just simply could mean that person sucked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, there's been quite a few, even within the community of Dearborn, that have ran and lost. And then now everybody in Dearborn is running, so yeah.
Which is unfortunate. Yeah. It's gotten crazy.
So, I mean, let's say that – I mean,
this is the state that has the only in the country, the only Muslim majority city council in Hamtramck.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I get that. And I guess even if I took religion out of it and just left it completely at race or cultural background. So when Obama won, it was a big hopeful thing for us. It was a maze, right? There were so many people who had, again, Saeed paid their dues, paid the dues, done what needed to be done so that we could have a black man elevated to the highest office in the land, right? And so there was this everlasting hope, whether we get it again in a few years or not, is irrelevant. It has happened. We got there. And so even if you took religion out of it, even if you took, you know, a conception of mistrust out of it, there are certain benchmarks that Muslim Americans have not gotten to as a culture. The reasons why we can parse that out if there's a loss, as much as you need to, I don't want to go into which ones, but I'm talking about how do you, as a group, move forward when it seems like hope gets deflated for a moment.
Well, first of all,
people had to regroup on that all the time.
Yeah, but those benchmarks or those firsts have already happened. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, Keith Ellison and Andre Carson, the two Muslim congresspeople, that's already happened. That's sort of in the vault.
Okay.
Yeah. Similarly, with at the state level in Michigan, I mean, you've got people like Rashida Tlaib. Right. You've got people running. You've got Abdul Hamid, who is now there. So this idea about people gunning to be first, I think you're just looking at now splitting hairs about what the first
what
is.
The first is, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or what it the is. First, yeah.
I guess there's just certain things like if a white man loses an election, white men do not have to regroup and rethink. What does it mean? You know, why did this happen?
What does it say about white people?
Yeah, what does it say about white people?
Yeah, and neither should Muslims. Neither should said candidate. You know,
but you haven't had the market share. Nor have black people had the market share, which is why those conversations
happen.
Yeah,
but Muslims as a demographic don't have the market share. It's only 1% of the population.
Right. But you still want what everybody else wants. 1% or not.
Sure.
You still want what everybody wants.
Yeah, but I just want somebody who's my congressperson who's not a jerk.
Right.
Yeah, you want somebody who's going to do the job, not necessarily of said religion. Right. Yeah.
I'm still –
which is all things considered,
I'm assuming your guy is the top guy, he's the smartest, and then loses. That's kind of –
Well, to me, I think that this is what then shows the distinction between what is Islamic and what is Muslim.
Okay.
Having the best candidate, irrespective of religion, who espouses and who personifies those values and virtues that you want, that is something that the Islamic side wants. Mm-hmm. If you just simply want somebody who's got the M word on him or her, well, then that's the Muslim in you talk.
And that could be anybody. Right? Yeah.
Okay. Is that unfair to want that, though?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I think it's Islamically unethical.
Yeah.
Just
because. I mean, I'm not saying solely. I mean, I didn't want Obama to win solely because he was black. I thought he was the best candidate. And so I'm thinking all things considered in this.
Yeah, but when Muslims have a 400-year-long era of persecution in this country and having to persevere and strive for civil rights, then we can talk about the Muslim narrative that way.
Okay.
So that, I think, has a lot to do with it. I mean, what Obama represented was really transcendent. I don't think that we can talk about Muslims in America yet in the same transcendental category.
Yeah, because
category.
We're pretty new.
I'm going to say this is the first time that I've ever been corrected on putting black people close to any other group. Like, hey, ours are similar. You're like, no, that's not similar. I'm like, whoa, I feel great about that. Thank you, Saeed.
I'm not trying to black-splain you.
No, it's totally fine. It's like, oh.
They'll take it.
I'm like, okay, that's cool.
But I think it's also important to understand the immigration patterns that brought Muslims to the United States and how Muslims ended up in the United States. And I think that both realities are true, that there is this level of Islamophobia that exists that's in all levels of society, going from the government all the way down to local communities.
Right.
But at the same time, Muslims also enjoy, especially compared to many parts of like rural Appalachian America, disproportionate levels of success. You know, we've had an Academy Award winner. We've had
a Golden Globe winner. We've got Aziz Ansari just won the Golden Globe.
Okay, there you go.
Oh, that's a great show, by the way.
You know, high achieving physicians, scientists, you know, engineers.
Forgive my ignorance for a moment.
Master of None.
Who's the Academy Award winner?
Mahershala Ali.
Okay, sure.
What was she in? House of Santa Fe?
He.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not thinking House of
Mahershala Ali. Moonlight.
Moonlight, yes. Okay. Which I have not seen yet.
Evidently, you have.
Sorry. Yes. I was thinking Angladush. What is her name? Oh, she's beautiful. She was in House of Sand and Fog. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
Oh, she's an Iranian actress.
Yeah. Oh, she's okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Continue. Mean, anyways, my point is that a lot of the first, you know, have been achieved in various aspects and various parts of our society, various parts of American society, you know, from athletes to entertainment to politics to law to science to, you know, whatever. And at the same time, we are also experiencing this extreme level of Islamophobia. That also exists, and those two things are realities. Now, there's also another important distinction to make, and this goes to the types of Muslims that we have in the United States. We have a large portion of Muslims that are immigrants that are new to the United States within the last 50 years, you know. Mm-hmm. But they've been here for the course of two or three or four generations now.
Right.
And so at what point does somebody cease to be an immigrant? You know, for me, I mean, I consider myself an immigrant just because I was born overseas. And so I'm not bothered by that, you know. But, you know, let's say my grandparents migrate to the United States, like many of my friends' grandparents did. At that point, they're not an immigrant anymore. Then you have another large section of the Muslim American community, which is African American, and they are facing many of the same challenges that the larger African American community in the United States.
You mean African American as in from Africa? African American.
No, okay. Meaning African American.
Oh, okay, African American. Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean,
yeah, that would just be African.
That would just be African.
Well, some people, it's interchangeable. Yeah, so,
like an immigrant from an African background is right. How I would describe.
Okay.
Them, you know, yeah. But you know, and you know, a couple of the examples that come to mind: Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Muhammad mm-hmm. Ali. You know, and so you know, those that part of our community faces challenges that are no different than what the larger African American community faces. And so their hopes are vested in sort of two worlds. So they might enjoy the benefits of having a first Muslim, you know, governor or whatever, but they also enjoy the benefits and the afterglow of having an African American president as well.
Okay.
And I think that their challenges and their realities are often or sometimes closer to their African-American brothers and sisters as opposed to their Muslim brothers and sisters who largely from an immigrant background enjoy some degree of affluence in the United States.
Okay. Well, I think that's a good place to take a break. We're going to take a 5-7 minute break and refuel, and we'll be back. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much. We're back from break. Let's dive right back into questions. All right. So we asked this question of the Christians who were on the panel last week, and I want to throw it out here to you all this week. But some claim that Islam is liberating to women. We've talked about that on a 2-hour podcast called Women in Islam that we did in the fall of last year. But others claim that Islam has been stifling and abusive to women. How do you see the treatment of women in Islam? And, of course, we have two women on our panel. I would like to throw it to you first. And this is Noor speaking.
Yeah.
Hey, Noor.
Let me just get my thoughts together.
Okay, well, you want to get your
thoughts? Yeah, and if you could speak directly into the mic, the front of the mic, not the top of the mic, that would be great for us.
I think Islam is very – this is Gina, and I think Islam is very liberating for women because women have a lot of rights, even though people seem to think that we don't. In Islam, women have a ton of rights. You know, we have rights of inheritance. We have rights over our children. We have rights in our own decisions. Even a woman in Islam, if she – wants to get down to detail, she could tell her husband that I don't have to cook and clean and do anything in the home. You have to pay me for it. So he would have to pay her to do laundry, to cook, to clean, to take care of the home.
Does this happen in a lot of Muslim homes? Because we need to get that program.
No. You know, it may. But if a woman wants to get down into like and say it, yeah, a man is her husband is responsible to pay her for those things. She's not required to do anything, you know, and, you know, I would say that it's let me go back to the question. It's liberating because we do have a lot of rights, and I don't think that it's been there is a lot of abuse in every culture and every religion. Mm-hmm. So we can't say that there is not abuse in Islam. There is. But to me, we like I've said earlier in the podcast, we have very fierce women in Islam that we follow.
I think you mentioned a few of them just to even start when I said, you know,
yeah,
what drew you to Islam.
Yeah, we have the prophet's daughter, his granddaughter, his nieces that have fought in battles, that have led tribes, that have kept Islam going, you know, through different majlis, like different religious gatherings and stuff. So we have very tough women in Islam that a lot of young girls say, well, I want to be like her when I grow up because, you know, when I heard the story of Sayyida Zainab, I thought to myself, wow. She is a bad lady. Like, she's a gangster. You know, like, I want to be like that when I, you know, in my raising of children. So I think we have a lot of good examples that do enforce those rights because nobody can, if I came today and I got married, we sign a contract. And even there's a clause in the contract that we'd sign that my husband could never, you know, take a second wife or, you know, because we are allowed four. Men are allowed four wives. So he could never take another spouse. And we have rights where we say, okay, you have to give us this dowry. If you're to divorce us, you have to give us X amount of money or gold. You know, you have to, we will always be supported. So women, we do have a lot of rights in that aspect.
Now, okay, so let me ask a question because that's fascinating that you just said that men are allowed four wives. Because within Christianity, you're not. You get one. That's it.
Well, God, you know, God, God says in the Quran that you are allowed four wives, but you have to treat them absolutely equal, which is impossible.
And so, it's also under the premise that the wives, I mean,
I'm not assuming that's the norm.
No, by any means.
But
even like the prophetic tradition, I mean, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the reason he had so many wives wasn't necessarily that he was enamored and in love with all of them. It was actually to protect them because many were widows and divorcees that nobody wanted. Like, they didn't have places to go. They didn't have money. So he was financially taking care of
them.
And
to bring tribes together as well. Yeah. He did that.
Okay, so there are a lot of political reasons for the marriage.
Right. So it's not common, I would say, in normal society. It might be in rural society where it might be common, but like that's going back to culture as well, you know. So I think that in today's society, it's not very common because God says, yeah, you can have four wives, but you have to treat them absolutely equal. So if you give one a house, you have to give the next one a house. And it's not even possible to love and two women at the same time equally. So that's why it kind of he gives you that option, but it's not really,
it's not really put into place.
Right. And, and that's where I think, I mean, that's, again, this is the first time I've heard that.
You've never heard that?
No, I mean, I've heard of multiple wives. There are multiple wives in like the Old Testament and things like that. No, I mean, but that's not the general.
It's not very common.
Yeah, that's and that's
not
the
meant to be a tool for a man to give into his like sexual pleasure. You know, for him to have four wives.
Right.
You know? It's purely because if like for example, one of my closest friends in high school, his dad passed away. And there were men at the mosque who offered to marry his mom, even though they already had wives and families, because they knew that she needed that financial support.
But also the first wife that the said man is, his first wife has to agree.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really think it's common for wives nowadays to be like, yeah, it's cool, get a second wife.
So, you know? So moving beyond multiple wives, we did talk last week how are women liberated within Christianity? But then we did address abuses, you know, where women aren't allowed to speak or where husbands are overbearing and things like that. And so we talked a little bit about how do we address what are clear abuses within our own faith. And that's when someone's like, well, you know, well, look at Islam. I've talked to plenty of Muslims. We're going to talk with them next week. And now we're talking with you. So when you do see abuses, because like you said, you see abuses in every religion, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just part and parcel to Islam. We have it in Christianity. They have it in Judaism. They have it in every other religion that's out there. You don't even have to be religious to abuse women. Hashtag me too, right?
Yeah.
So, but when you do see abuses within Islam, towards women specifically, how's that addressed? How's that addressed within your home or your community? How's that taken care of?
So I think, a couple of the abuses that I've seen that happen within Islam are purely cultural. FGM is rampant in, you know, like Africa, you know, some parts.
You mean female genital mutilation?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And then some parts of, or like, you know, like Southeast Asia. So all of those things are guised under religion as being right.
Okay.
But they are purely cultural. And that's where I was going to get towards the treatment of women in Islam. If you look at just Islam, is in my eyes perfect. It is very liberating, but the treatment of women by many Muslims is what's a detriment, because the way many Muslims perceive women derives from their own culture. You know, so like Arab Desi culture, they sometimes have these notions that they project onto women, that the women within these cultural groups don't know any better, and they themselves conflate it with Islam, and that's how this continues to go, and the cycle continues, because if women isn't educated enough, that's how these human rights atrocities.
And I like how she said that, because here I've noticed certain people of certain ethnic backgrounds treat their wives a certain way, like, I am the man of the house, you have to listen to me, such and such. But then where I live with my husband in our society in East Africa, the women are treated with a very high respect. You know, the wife is above everything. So it's interesting to see in different cultures and different countries how women are treated, because it should be, what should be ideally is a woman should be treated good.
Okay.
You know, and then, or a divorcee. Here, I've noticed that divorcees have this X on their forehead that's like, oh, she's divorced, she has baggage, I don't want to be married to her. But then overseas, you'll have men that will marry these divorcees because they say, well, this is Islam. They should get married before anybody else because these are the women that might be left back in society when that's not how it's supposed to be at all.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, even prominent ex-Muslims like Ayan Hirsi Ali and Esther Nomani, both of their problems with Islam, again, derive from cultural institutional practices. Like Ayan Hirsi Ali was a victim of FGM. And she conflated that with Islam.
Is she the one that I constantly see on Fox News?
Yes.
She's the one that I wanted to have on the show at some point. Okay.
She's really angry.
Very angry. Lives somewhere in Europe now.
No. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah, that's she's here in the United States.
She's here now.
She's married to Neil Ferguson, who's a historian at Harvard.
Oh. Well,
okay. So let's talk. We talked about religion takes place within culture earlier, and we're talking about now the abuses that we see by and large towards women in Islam are almost purely cultural. So if you had to pick a cultural container in which to put Islam, which seems to be the best? Now, you just said Tanzania is great, right?
Yeah.
Are there any other cultures in which to place Islam where the perfection of the Quranic teachings about men treating women a certain way and women treating women a certain way as well, is there a cultural container where Islam and the treatment of women would flourish the best?
You know, I'd like to say that I think that a lot of converts, a lot of men, let's say, that come to Islam, they would follow the proper way the best because they studied it more. A lot of, no offense to anybody that's born Muslim, but from my own experience, I've seen that a lot of people that are that have converted to Islam, since they've studied it so hard, you know, they didn't grow up with it and they didn't have their parents teaching them. They say, okay, well, this is what the Quran says. This is what the Hadith say. This is what I have to do. And they actually like follow it hardcore, where other people are kind of more laxed, where they do fall back into their culture, where converts don't have a culture anymore because they follow, you know, now they're into a new religion and things. So I think that I like how converts, men would or women would treat each other, but I'm not sure what other culture.
I really wouldn't want to put.
I wouldn't want to say it's a culture
because that just generalizes it. I mean,
you can't say A is better than B.
Well, yeah. I'm just wondering. I mean, there's when we did our Women in Islam panel, we talked about women were just allowed to drive for the first time in Saudi Arabia. Is that right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And so people were like, well, you know, that's actually just covering up, you know, human rights abuses, not towards women necessarily, but just
it
in general.
It was a PR move. Yeah.
Right. It's a PR move. And so obviously, if women are just starting to get driver's licenses in Saudi Arabia, I don't know if that would be the culture that people would say that's the culture where women flourish the most. So I'm asking, like, is there a country? Is there a culture? Like you said, Tanzania. So is there another Muslim country where women have far more rights and it's closer to Quranic teaching? Or, I mean, obviously they all have their problems.
I think a lot of people are going to disagree with me, but Iran, to me, because I've been to Iran before. I was actually going to go study in Hausa there. So to me, Iran, when it comes to women, women are very highly, highly educated and highly regarded as opposed to what. And it's funny, though, I've seen like women driving in the front seat and their husbands in the back seat. And, you know, they're very forward, straightforward and tough. And I found that women in Iran have had a lot of very high rights and positions as well.
I would have to disagree just because I'm half Iranian.
Oh.
So Iran is kind of, it really depends on where you go in Iran. In Tehran, the women there do have access to more rights. But I'm actually from Qom, where Hausa is located. Mm-hmm. And the way women are treated there is pretty ridiculous. You know, you're forced to wear a chador. Not everybody there wants to wear a chador.
Can you explain what that is just for – I don't know what it is. So
a chador is essentially the hijab included with like the long traditional black cloth that people would call abaya. But it's all connected.
Okay.
So it's just like one piece of clothing that you put over.
Is that different than a burqa?
Yeah, because you don't cover your face.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, the women there are educated, but they're not expected to go high up. So all my cousins overseas, when I ask them, like, what are you going into? It's either you're becoming a nurse or a teacher. Becoming a doctor, becoming a professor, becoming a lawyer. Those aren't things that women are supposed to be doing overseas. It's very uncommon to see a woman have multiple degrees under her belt unless she was Christian or Jewish, because they're granted a lot more rights in Iran than a lot of Muslims are.
Hmm.
And most people don't actually know that. So I would have to disagree, but but you know.
But is there a container that you can look at and go, hey, it does flourish in this other space?
Different parts, I would say, though. I would say in rural Iran, Isfahan, it's not as women are, it's not that they're not educated, they're just not pushed, like, go to school. They're kind of more pushed, like, hey, go get married, mm-hmm. you know? Mm.
Okay. I would maybe point out to Indonesia, because just from the way I've read about Indonesia and their Muslim community.
Somebody's phone's going off. It doesn't matter.
The way that I've read about Indonesia and its Muslim community is that all the women there are expected to receive an education. They're also put into Islamic education, so they know the religion that they follow. And Muslims are the main politicians in that country. So.
In a 2015 Newsweek article, Nasser Kader, am I pronouncing that right? Anyone?
Sure.
Okay, sure. Nasser Kader wrote, and thanks, Calvin, for the gigantic brick of text.
I can read it if you like.
No, I got it. We who believe in a peaceful faith and the sanctity of life must demand nothing less than an Islamic reformation. Moderate Muslims all across the world need to help revolutionize Islam to get rid of the cancer that has been spread among us. In a response to this idea, Mehdi Hassan wrote in The Guardian, quote, "Don't get me wrong. Reforms are, of course, needed across the crisis-ridden Muslim-majority world, political, socioeconomic, and yes, religious too. Muslims need to rediscover their own heritage of pluralism, tolerance, and mutual respect embodied in the Prophet's letter to the monks of St. Catherine's Monastery or the convivencia or coexistence of medieval Muslim Spain. What they don't need are lazy calls for an Islamic reformation from non-Muslims and ex-Muslims, the repetition of which merely illustrates how shallow and simplistic, how ahistorical and even anti-historical some of the West's leading commentators are on this issue," unquote. What are your thoughts on any of that? Does Islam need a reformation? We can take a break while you revisit that question. Does Islam need a reformation? If yes, why? If no, why not?
No, I think that certain schools of thought do. And I'm not going to really explain which schools of thought, but I think the radical people that follow radical Islam that don't really follow the religion of Islam and what it states, that they use Islam as a, something to hide behind, those people need to get it together. But I would say that I don't think that Islam needs a reform for people of sound mind.
Okay.
Again, I'd have to say that Islam itself is perfect.
Yeah, I think we're all going to have that opinion. Yeah. You know?
It is the adherents, the followers, and I'd have to agree with Mehdi Hassan on this, that do need a reformation of the mind. There needs to be some kind of like desire for a Muslim to want to know about the religion that they follow. There's an Imam Ali quote that I kind of go by. It's learn your religion, do not inherit it. And I think it's incredibly true, because a lot of folks are just using, calling themselves a Muslim merely because their mom and dad are Muslims and they attended the mosque, the masjid, while they were growing up. But I know people who are like well into their 20s, well into their 30s, who can't even list off the five pillars or the six pillars of faith, or who don't necessarily understand why we're prohibited to do a certain thing and not the other. And they don't know the prophetic tradition on certain, like marriage and family and interactions with people who aren't Muslims.
You know, I like how they mentioned medieval Muslim Spain, because I studied Cordoba, and back in its time, it was more advanced than some Muslim, quote-unquote, societies are today in certain part of the Middle East.
You can keep going.
Oh, okay. No. I thought you wanted us to stop.
No.
No, so I think that medieval Muslim, I like how he said that somebody that is not Muslim shouldn't have that kind of, shouldn't say, you guys should be reformed and you should change, because if you have not studied the religion or follow the religion, I don't believe that somebody should have that kind of strong of an opinion. It's very offensive.
I don't think that people are calling per se for the reformation of Islam theologically. I think that they're talking about Islam by and large as to how can it then fit into a modern, no longer Muslim-dominated civilizationally paradigm. And on the one hand, at the same time,
You've got the West that demands this. And when they talk about Reformation, essentially what they're talking about is a Luther-like Reformation,
right,
which is then demolishing the monopoly of church power and then bifurcating it into a temporal power and religious power. That was something that was never in conflict within Islam ever. Yeah. So to go ahead and demand something that never existed is, you know, any number times zero is zero. So that becomes then a non-starter. At the same time, I think that it is important to recognize that whether we like it or not, and whether we would appreciate it or not, I don't think, and this is going to be, let me go ahead and qualify this by saying it's really in academic terms, I don't see anything wrong necessarily with the existence of radicals in any religious tradition or in any kind of society, because you cannot define the moderate unless you have the radical. You can't just have one pangeic demographic of people. It doesn't make any sense. There's no parameters to it. There's no boundaries to it. There's no borders to it. The only reason why moderates exist is in contrast to the existence of radicals, and vice versa. And similarly, when it comes to this notion of the secular doesn't know where it begins and where it ends unless it is juxtaposed to the religious.
But radical, when you're talking about, I mean, moderate in politics is one thing. Oh, you got your moderate Republicans, your moderate Democrats. That's fine. I think that you have to parse that a little bit, primarily because the word radical, when you add religion to it, whether it be Christian, Muslim, Jewish, whatever, is often associated with, you know, heinous acts. And so, you're right, semantically speaking. Yeah. But I think when you were talking about radicals in religion, most people, because of PR at this point, assume a radical is – it's a pejorative term. It is not.
Only
it's not a.
When it comes to non-Christian religious communities from a Christian lens. Otherwise, the word radical is pervasively used to describe Jesus Christ and the mission that he had. So I think it's important.
I have seen a number of Christian books where radical. Actually, one is called Radical. So yeah, okay, all right. Yeah.
So I think that that's really also very important to have. Look, there are clearly fault lines within the Islamic narrative that need to be addressed. I think that most of them don't have to do per se with the deficiencies from a theological standpoint. You know, I posted something on Facebook and it came back up. I said, you know, for those who say that they music means more to them than their faith, it doesn't have to do with the fact they don't have faith. It just happens to do with the fact that their stereo is much better than their sheikh. And I think that in many cases that's exactly what it is that either because of a lack of intellectual curiosity, a lack of desire to do the heavy lifting, I think a very genuine sense of confusion and overload about how do you deal with this thing called Islam, which is such an oceanic phenomenon in a world that no longer has the kinds of anchors that perhaps one time people thought and took for granted. I mean, the example of the convivencia of Muslim Spain. I mean, Muslim Spain will never, ever, ever come back. And part of the reason is that you will never have, in general terms, the kind of static society worldwide that you did
At that time.
I mean, the world has gotten so much more complex today. And this is the same way that when people hearken or yearn for the golden age of Islam and about when the time the Prophet was around. The one thing that the Prophet never had to deal with that Muslims today have to deal with all due respect, obviously, to the Prophet, is cultural heterogeneity. Everybody in the Arabian Peninsula was an Arab. We have to deal with a cultural mosaic, which, as we've been talking about now, far more complicates the issue than any kind of theological diversity that exists.
Okay. What about you?
I'll try to make my comments quick. Generally, I agree with Mehdi Hassan's response. I think it is kind of lazy for somebody that doesn't understand the complexities of the tradition that's just responding to what's perceived to be the societal dysfunctions of Muslim societies. And when they talk about Islam needs a reformation, what are they talking about? You know, in my I think you know, there are these extreme examples of what people are thinking of when they're thinking about reformation of Islam. You know, they're thinking about examples of Saudi Arabia or Iran or other examples where there's a perceived level of dysfunctional or radical ideology, and that's what they're trying to address. Now, for any rational thinking Muslim, I think it's pretty easy to accept this idea that, yeah, I mean, there are aspects within Islam that could be reformed, could be changed to make life better for people in society. Or issues around women, you know, for instance, divorce, inheritance, you know, for example. You know, I think it's a profound lack of understanding of the nuances of the economic, of the societal, of the cultural factors that lead to some of this dysfunction that these people are responding to or that they're calling a reformation for.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and I do find that somewhat similar to Christian responses to this kind of thing, and even Jewish responses to this as well, more along the lines of, I think we do find ourselves in a cultural time, and I'll move on to the next question real quick, but just a statement I wanted to make, but people look at religion, especially the Abrahamic phase, as archaic, out of touch with, you know, the current cultural milieu. And so you have things like, I believe that, I know Christianity says, you know, marriage is between a man and a woman. You know, we believe in the sanctity of life, that children should be spared in the womb, and things like that. And so I think Islam shares those beliefs. And so when those beliefs are bumped up against by a culture that is now accepting things that our faith say, you know, no. A lot of times when people are calling for a reformation, I've seen this within Christianity, I'm seeing it within Islam, we're calling for a reformation because we don't like that idea and you need to change your religious belief yes. to fit what we believe now in the culture.
Yeah, but there's a contradiction. I mean, when Christians ask for that or when they're looking for reformation, they seek to reform society, not the theology. And
right.
so the idea then of the demand that Muslims reform the theology, essentially what they're doing is they're saying, well, basically you should nullify your theology.
Well, yours is coming from within. Some of ours is coming from within, but most of that comes from without. Like, we don't like what you believe. You need to change it or you're antiquated and backwater. But there are also – I was in a class out in – I'm going to Biola University out in La Mirada, and it was a class called Addressing Homosexuality. And most of the people there were conservative Christian, but there were a group of people who I found solidarity with who were the LGBTQ Christian network out in L.A. And they're saying from within, we need a reformation. We need to change – the theology. We need to change the belief. And so there's some from within, there's some from without, and I think within both groups. But unfortunately, we need to move on because I do want to get this last question, and we've only got about 10 minutes in which to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict. let's talk about
Jared.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Wait, I thought he was in jail after the whole subway debacle. Jared.
Different Jared. Yeah.
Many evangelical Christians seem to be pro-Israel for purely prophetic reasons rather than political. Both Jews and Muslims make prophetic and political claims to the region. What are the contours of the conflict, and how can the conflict – I'm not even going to ask that, the second part, because I don't think that's a fair question to ask. What are the contours of this conflict? How did this start? Why is it going on?
I really – so we're learning about this actually in my class.
And we literally have, unfortunately, like 7 minutes to talk about this.
Okay.
so wrap it up.
Yes. So we're talking about this in my class, and a lot of it has to do with the way history has been written, the way Israel has been put in instead of Palestine. And that was intentional. That was so that, you know, people who are Christian, they see Israel as the Holy Land, and as a land that they also take claim and part of, not just the Jews, but also the prophets, you know, the prophetic reasons. Mm-hmm. They were from the land of Israel, even though Jesus was Palestinian. He was a Palestinian Jew.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think a lot of it has to do with lack of education on just the region in general, and the way history has been played out and written.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I think that it's important to recognize that this conflict really begins in the last 5% of the history of Muslims and Jews, a history which 95% was really bereft of conflict. And what we have here is – and what's really tragic is two peoples who both have borrowed from the playbook of somebody else's narrative, and that really is the development of modern Western nationalism. And so what we find then is that modern Zionism, which is sort of the Jewish narrative to connect the Jewish people to Israel-Palestine, is something that comes about from a very specific and located history and culture that the Jewish people in Europe had to endure. And at the same time, we find that the counterpoint is an effort by Arabs to develop their own nationalism in what was the declining and decaying Ottoman Empire. In both the Arab and the Jewish cases, we have the British, the French, and other interests who wanted to advance their own strategic objectives in the way. And so in many ways, what they did is they either allowed for or blatantly encouraged the development of these really artificial narratives, which were never endemic to either Arab slash Muslim or Christian or Jewish history. And so now we find over 100 years after the Balfour Declaration, which in many ways kicks this whole thing off, the confusion and essentially a very weak foundation upon which both the Arab and the Israeli side are building these histories and futures.
Actually, I wanted to just make a quick point. It says many evangelical Christians seem to be pro-Israel, but if you actually watch the interviews of the Palestinian Christians, they are not pro-Israel. They say that we just want everybody, because you know how they have Trump that's trying to bring
I wouldn't put Palestinian Christians in the evangelical.
No?
Evangelical
bucket.
Would be
I wouldn't
Baptist.
Put them in that bucket.
Mainline.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, not even mainline. I mean, you're basically talking about very specifically American evangelical
yeah,
Christians.
You can go to a lot of mainline Christian churches in America who are very pro-Palestine.
Yeah, Presbyterians they've in fact passed
but
a
evangelical
a
Christians overwhelmingly
so
voted for Donald Trump. Donald Trump has recently said that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel.
Right.
You know, much to the chagrin of the international community.
Mm-hmm.
Evangelicals, of course, applauded this, right? Mainly because they don't know what's going on in the region politically. They just know Jesus is supposed to come back there. That's where Jesus is from. Although Nora, you said, "Yeah, Jesus is a Palestinian Jew." No one wants to hear that.
Yeah,
just so
yeah.
you know, no one wants to hear that.
So on Christmas, I actually posted Prophet Jesus was a Palestinian Jew. Merry Christmas! And then so many people were like, "Actually, he's from the tribe of Hebrews," and they were trying to correct me. I was like, I'm just not.
You see, this is a map.
Yeah.
It's how they work.
I think a lot of it too, is, and you saw this with the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Israel. The nation of Israel is essentially victims. You know, people. You know, the Jewish people were victims of a genocide. They were in Europe, and they're using that victimhood as a tool of oppression. And they did that. They're doing it right now constantly to Palestinians. And to go back to the trial of Adolf Eichmann, they used that trial to, like, showcase to the world that we are a superpower. Jews are fully capable of fighting against people who don't like us, you know. And it's been this continuous thing. It's been this, like, national, like this pride that they have because they were victims. I mean, they were victims of genocide for, like, millennia. You know, the Babylonian exile, whatever. And it's within like the last 50 years, I feel like they've finally been able to establish a state that has been their own and to really kind of flourish.
Is it safe to say that the panelists here are pro-Palestine?
I am. Yeah, I am.
Okay.
I don't understand terms of pro and anti on this issue, quite frankly. I mean, I think what you do is you have peoples who are contesting for the same piece of real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to discount the truth claims that either side is making for it. I think one of the things that becomes objectionable is to what extent, A, they're going to then try to contest it, and what justification, B, they make in order to validate the measures that they take in order to advance those truth claims.
Do both sides have the right to exist?
I believe so.
Yes.
Of course. Everybody has the right to live and exist peacefully.
I find the question actually to be a bit problematic, because irrespective of whether one recognizes their right to exist, which I do as a disclaimer, it's irrelevant because they do exist.
Right.
And so, you know, the train's left the station on that one. And so the fact that people are still arguing on that is really extraneous to what really needs to be done to resolve this issue.
It's like arguing if Iowa has a right to exist.
Right to exist is it's this weird political term.
Right.
It's not like
would you say
they don't
right
exist.
To, right to live there, like
no. Right to exist as a nation state.
Okay.
There was a question, and still is an ongoing question, whether they exist or not. do they have the right to exist? And so that seems to be something that fuels what's going on, not just in this part of the world. There are other parts of the world where this kind of thing happens as well. I didn't know that until I did a little bit of light reading on it. Obviously, you're going to be more of an expert on that than I would, Saeed, but unfortunately we're out of time, and I will come and sit in your class and learn from you. So all of you, thank you. Obviously, I didn't think that we were going to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict, but because you all are here and then next week we have Jewish people on, I wanted to at least broach the topic and talk about it a little bit. We probably need to have a full panel on that particular topic. So 7 minutes is not enough.
Wrap it up before it starts.
But I do want to thank all of you for being here. Absolute pleasure hearing all of your answers, thoughtful responses, things that will have me scratching my head, and of course blowing up your phone, Saeed, as I always do after you are on the panel. After we have one of these panels, I've got more questions. Like what's
going on? I'm just glad that you use the phrase "blowing up," not me.
Yeah. Ooh, too soon. Oh, no. God, you're on fire. Okay, so thank you all. Thank you all for being here, and for our listeners,
thank you for having us.
No problem. Thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure to check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season and the last two seasons, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com and we'll get back to you. Don't forget, you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and the Podcast Detroit app. Please leave us a review. And tune in next week where Kent and I will continue our series titled Sacred Space. We've invited on several Jewish people to discuss their experiences as faithful followers of Judaism. See you next week.